Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, Wasabi, the newly crowned Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show Champion, and his handler, who is also one of his owners, joins us. But up front, when Pennsylvania increased its tax on gasoline to 58 cents per gallon a few years back, it's the second highest in the nation, it was supposed to go a long way toward paying to modernize and repair the state's transportation infrastructure. While more money did go for transportation projects, something unexpected happened along the way. Much of the funding was used to pay for state police operations. More municipalities have been eliminating their police departments and using state police to patrol their towns and townships, which is a factor as well. While Pennsylvania continues to face the challenge of paying for transportation projects, the Biden administration and congressional Republicans in Washington are debating infrastructure funding as well. But Pennsylvania does have money from the federal government right now, COVID relief funds. Could that money be used for transportation? Joining us is Robert Latham, Executive Vice President of the Associated Pennsylvania Constructors. Mr. Latham, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here. Appreciate the time.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Bob Latham, you're proposing using some of the COVID relief money for funding state police and then using that money
So what we've seen over the last couple of years is a marked decrease in construction money available for projects throughout Pennsylvania. You mentioned, Scott, earlier that we raised the fuel tax back in 2013. We have the second highest fuel tax in the country. And unfortunately, then we started to take more and more of that money. Actually, 11 cents per gallon of that fuel tax is now going to the Pennsylvania General Fund to support the budget of the state police. State police budget definitely needs to be supported. So we're not saying that should be cut. We're saying now that the general fund has a balanced budget. The revenues are coming in greater than expected, the state revenues. And then on top of that, we have $7.2 billion over 2 years coming to the general fund. So it's a very simple proposition. Stop taking the money from the motor license fund. Stop taking that 11 cents per gallon. Leave that in the motor license fund for road and bridge projects, and then pay for the state police out of the COVID relief money that were known as the American Rescue Plan.
So how much money are we talking about?
Well, in this year's budget, we have $700 million coming from the Pennsylvania Motor License Fund or the Highway Fund or the gas tax, as your listeners might think of it. That's a lot of money. Again, since we passed the increase in funding back in 2013, $5.2 billion has been shifted to the general fund. You know, and that was done under the auspices of, well, we have a general fund deficit. Well, now we don't have a general fund deficit. And so we're asking that money be placed back in the motor license fund for 2 years. We can move a lot of projects forward. We can employ a lot of people. We're talking about restarting the economy. And this would be a great way to put people back to work and also do more safety improvements, road improvements throughout the Commonwealth over a couple of year period of time, while there's this extra money that can be used.
So it's $700 million per year, and you're proposing over 2 years that money be filled in for the state police with these COVID relief funds. So you're talking about a total of $1.4 billion. As you're well aware, there's going to be a lot of people, a lot of agencies, a lot of causes that are going to want some of this money. This is kind of a once-in-a-lifetime situation. So make the case for this being a good use of COVID money, that filling in the state police budget and using that money for highway projects or transportation projects.
Certainly. So we have seen a drop in the construction program over the last 2 years, starting with COVID and then this year. And we have a tremendous backlog of needs for highway improvements and highway construction. And the thing about it is you can put people back to work. You can do road improvements. One of the things we've seen over the last several years is we were able to fix a number of bridges. Now that bridge inventory is kind of going back up. Again, we have additional monies available. There is, some of the programs that are funded by the general fund received direct federal monies outside the $7.2 billion. For example, education, I know, and some local governments, public transit has already received about $1.5 billion just in Pennsylvania alone. So, you know, the highway program is sort of the orphan that's been left out there without any COVID relief money. And this is a good way to put people back to work, fix our roads, make things safer for people to travel around the Commonwealth.
When you say put people back to work, you actually have a figure, from what I understand, of how many people or how many jobs this could create. What number are you looking at?
Well, I think that, the rule of thumb is about 13,000 jobs for every billion dollars in highway construction. That's across the economy. That's direct jobs on projects. That's engineering, material production, people working in and around the industry. The other thing that's important to note is outside the highway construction industry, we've changed to a distribution economy. We're doing a lot of shopping online, a lot of deliveries coming home. I noticed that there are more and more of these distribution warehouses being built along our interstates. This is creating a lot of stress on our transportation system. So as we move away from a bricks and mortar retail economy to one of home delivery, and more goods and services being shipped on our roads, we're going to have stress on those highways, and we're going to have to meet that need. This, of course, what we're talking about here is a very short-term proposal. I understand that. But this will be a bridge, no pun intended, a bridge funding to get us through to see whether or not there is a federal program that is enacted. We've been hearing about a federal infrastructure program for several months. And on a parallel track with that, they're looking at what they call reauthorization of the federal highway transportation program. Those things are not really going to come online until the fall and or next year. But this proposal that we have will allow us to move some projects forward immediately.
Now, as you said, this is temporary. What you're proposing is that the COVID relief money be used to fund the state police operations. And we're not talking about all of it, but fund the state police operations. But after that, those 2 years, what you're saying is that what can happen is that the state police operations can go back to being funded as was intended. And that includes and transportation as well. That includes a reliance on fuel taxes. We've talked about it on this program several times. Everyone, including yourself, but PennDOT is aware of it. Everyone across the country is aware of it, that with electric vehicles coming, vehicles being more fuel efficient, there will be changes in how revenue is generated for transportation. There can't be a reliance on fuel taxes. There will have to be some alternative to that. So when you say this is temporary, are you looking down the line 2 years from now that fuel taxes, there will be enough money there to do what it was intended to do, transportation projects?
Well, Scott, you're absolutely right. There's a continued, drop in revenues from the fuel tax because we have a consumption-based tax, a tax based on the consumption of gasoline and diesel fuel. And you're right, as more and more vehicles fueled by either electricity or cell battery or what have you come online, obviously those revenues are going to continue to recede. We will have to find an alternative to the fuel tax. And interestingly enough, Governor Wolf has created what he calls a Transportation Revenue Options Commission that's been meeting for a couple of months. They have a report that is going to be due out in August. And I think that that group is going to recommend a move away from the fuel consumption tax towards a more mileage-based user fee. Now, people say, well, how do you implement that? And that's really what's going to be the question is, how do you implement a mileage-based user fee? Understand that there is there's a national gasoline tax, there are state gasoline taxes. Obviously, we're surrounded by other states. So how do you implement something like that in Pennsylvania without having it be implemented in, say, New Jersey, Maryland, New York, you know, Ohio, et cetera? So those are some things that are going to take some time to figure out. My personal belief is it's going to take a national effort to move in that direction. So I think we're going to be still reliant on the fuel tax for a great portion of our revenue. Right now, it's about 75%. And as we said, dropping. I think that there will have to be some sort of augmented registration fee that's been talked about in the General Assembly for a number of years. On those electric vehicles while we make that transition to a mileage-based fee.
If you're just tuning in, our guest during this portion of the program is Robert Latham. He's Executive Vice President of the Associated Pennsylvania Constructors. We're talking about a proposal that Mr. Latham has and constructors have of using COVID relief money to pay for state police operations, and money that has been taken out of the transportation fund the last few years would be used for transportation projects. Your thoughts on it? 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So before we get back into the proposal itself, Bob, wanted to ask you, what do you see as the state's transportation priorities right now?
Well, you know, as always, it is maintaining the existing highway system that we have. So we have a very large state network because of the composition of our state as a state municipal makeup. So PennDOT, for example, maintains 40,000 miles of road. That's more than the states of New York and New England combined, just to give you some perspective. That's a lot of roads. We also have 70,000 miles of local roads that need to be maintained. So I would say maintenance of our existing roads right now, upgrading the system, continuing to make improvements on our bridges. One of the positive things from Act 89, or that transportation funding bill that raised the fuel tax you mentioned earlier, is that we went from an inventory of 6,000 what we call bad bridges or structurally deficient bridges, bridges that need to be fixed, to 3,000. Now, 3,000 sounds like a lot, but we have 25,000 bridges in Pennsylvania. And that's just because of our topography and the way the state is made up. So we have a lot of bridges. We've cut the inventory of bad bridges. We need to continue to do that. In addition to that, we have almost 2,000 miles of interstate highway in our state. You know, think about it, 80 out west, 79, 83 here, 81 in central Pennsylvania, 95. So we got a lot of interstate highways, we got a lot of major roadways, and because of the freeze-thaw situation that we have, we continually have to upgrade those projects. So we're not talking about a lot of new roadways. We're talking really about maintaining and continuing to upgrade, modernize our existing system.
Let's take a phone call from Kathy in Campbelltown. Kathy, you're on Smart Talk.
Good morning. I'm listening to the discussion about funding through taxation of various ways, but until we change somehow the fact that a lot of the taxation from fuel goes to state police coverage for municipalities that don't have their own police forces, I don't see how changing any taxation funding is going to change anything.
Well, that's what he's talking about, is using some of that COVID relief money for state police. But, Kathy, you bring up another point. Thank you very much for your call. Yeah, the proposal you're talking about is looking at a way to fund state police operations over the next couple years and then to make it permanent. Say that doesn't happen. I mean, Governor Wolf has proposed in the last few years every one of his budgets as a way for to come up with some money from those municipalities that are using state police as basically their police force, that they've either eliminated their police departments or they had no police department in the first place. I know you're making this proposal, and that's what you probably are counting a lot on. But if that doesn't happen, what about those municipalities that are using state police?
Well, we certainly appreciate that the governor has put this proposal forth for about the last 5 or 6 years. And it has certainly brought this issue to light that that we are spending more and more money. We are shifting more and more money. Again, this year alone, 11 cents a gallon of the gas tax that we all pay is going to the general fund to pay for the state police. And that there are more and more municipalities that are giving up their own municipal forces. Personally, I think it's a fair proposal either people in municipalities that are relying on the state police could pay something into that. We supported it. Unfortunately, it's a political non-starter at this point. So I mean, I guess that's kind of a question for the leaders of the General Assembly, why that never moves. I think that there is resistance from local governments to it. There's an argument that while we're focusing on the municipalities that don't have a police force, the majority of state police call outs to municipalities are actually those that have their own police force, specifically major metropolitan areas. And so then there's a lot of debate going back and forth. And just unfortunately, this is that's a proposal that just doesn't seem to get off the ground at this point, which is why when we continue to point out that we're taking more and more money out of the motor license fund, out of the highway fund, and the response from legislators has been, well, we have no way to back and fill that gap if we move the money back. And what we're saying is, at least for a couple of years, we can move some projects forward. We have that stopgap now. We have the revenues are coming into the general fund greater than anticipated, so the budget is balanced. Plus, you've got $3.6 billion per year over the next 2 years. That's still, even if our full proposal were successful, it still leaves $6 billion over the next 2 years for other programs. So, yes, that'll leave us, some soul searching and some things to do when this money runs out. We don't want to just find ourselves, stranded with no funding at the end of that. But it leaves 2.5 years for folks to figure out what's the appropriate level of highway patrol to be paid for from the motor license fund. We think it's a lot less than $700 million a year.
Mm-hmm. When you were talking, Bob, about the state's transportation priorities, it sounded as if what you were describing is we're in catch-up mode, that we have to catch up rather than really be thinking ahead to the future. That's not a good situation to be in.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, where we are is really thinking mostly about maintaining our existing system. Now, when you look at the future, there's going to be an increase in surface transportation travel, whether it be vehicles powered by battery or plug-in or what have you. So we're not looking in the near term, over the next couple of decades at a major shift in mobility. We're not going to be flying from point A to point B. We're still going to be using surface transportation vehicles to move goods and services and to move people around. I think that there's going to be a role for public transit, obviously. going forward. There's going to be, we're looking at the potential for automated vehicles, but these vehicles, public transit vehicles and automated vehicles, they still use roads. And so we have to continue to maintain what we have before we can look at any enhancements, if you will. So looking at some of our interstate highways, maybe adding lanes, adding climbing lanes for trucks in some of our mountains, again, fixing our bridges and that sort of thing, making the system more efficient, but certainly not not huge amounts of new projects.
We have a caller who asks, why do we have the public subsidizing the warehouses and trucking industry? These trucks are what tear up the roads. They use our infrastructure. Why are we stuck with the bill? And, one thing that you mentioned is that, and we actually had another caller brought this up, that the traffic has changed during the pandemic, in that you have so many people that are ordering from Amazon or buying online. That saw just a story on Network News the other night about an increase in truck traffic on the nation's interstate or highways because so many people have been ordering online rather than going to retail stores. Now, maybe that changes once the pandemic is over, but still, we've had seen some changes over the last year. But getting back to that original question from the listener about subsidizing warehouses and trucks.
Certainly. The good news for the listener is that's actually being looked at and I think is going to be addressed. So the Governor's Transportation Revenue Options Commission is actually looking at that phenomenon as perhaps a piece of the funding source going forward. So, and specifically, the cost of delivery of goods and the cost of shipping as it relates to use of the roads. Now, understand that the trucking industry itself, the over-the-road haulers, are separate from the owners of warehouses and distributors, and certainly the Amazon phenomenon, if you will, is a little bit different as well. So, but I think listeners have to understand that the trucking industry pay pretty high. We have the highest truck registration rate in the Commonwealth. And just like the gas tax, we have one of the highest diesel fuel tax rates in the country. So the trucking industry, if they were on here today, would make an argument that they are paying a pretty high amount of highway user fees. Now, the question is, with all this additional commerce on the roads as a result of home delivery and online shopping, is there an opportunity there to look at that industry or that phenomenon sort of helping to pay for the use of roads, both at the state and the local level? And that's something that I think that your listeners are going to want to keep a close eye on with the Revenue Options Commission and its report that comes out, because I think that they're going to address that.
So, Bob, we only have a minute or so left. I wanted to thank you very much for being with us today. What you're proposing with using COVID relief money for state police operations and the money that has been spent on that over recent years going to transportation projects, is that in legislative form? I mean, this is something that ultimately the legislature and the governor will have to make a decision on.
Yes, absolutely. And we've been actually pleased and encouraged. We've gotten a good reception for this initiative. I think that it is part and parcel of the budget discussions. The Commonwealth, the General Assembly, and the governor have to come together and pass a budget at the end of June. And this is under consideration. We're hopeful that it will stay in if this comes to fruition, it would be part of the budget package that is passed by the end of June. So there are some bills in the legislature that would that continue to sort of step this down, if you will. But ultimately, this proposal will be part and parcel of the budget.
Hey, just before we leave, I did want to read an email we got from a listener. Sandra says, COVID funds are meant to help folks who are struggling. We are facing an eviction crisis, among other things, and these funds should be used for the intended purposes, not for just another one-time fix. Why not push for a permanent fix to the Pennsylvania State Police funding issue? And I think that that's, overall, that's what, I mean, there's a couple of things that that email brings up. And that is the question I asked earlier about there are going to be a lot of different causes and people looking for ways to use that money. But also, Pennsylvania does have to come up with some solution to the state police funding issue. Robert Latham is Executive Vice President of the Associated Pennsylvania Constructors. Bob Latham, thank you very much for being with us today.
Scott, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Central Pennsylvania is home to a new champion. The three-year-old Pekingese Wasabi won the Best in Show title at the prestigious Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show last weekend. Wasabi's home is in East Berlin in Adams County, and two of his owners are from Central Pennsylvania. One of them, breeder, part owner, and handler David Fitzpatrick, joins us today. Mr. Fitzpatrick, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And I know we have listeners out there that love to speak to you about Wasabi. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org on Twitter. We are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. First of all, congratulations. You've had a few days to let this sink in. Thoughts on Wasabi's win?
Well, I'm still overwhelmed and shocked. We went to Westminster this year not expecting to win Best in Show. I don't know that anyone ever does, but we just wanted to enjoy the experience, and we were so grateful that during the pandemic that this 145-year-old continuing tradition of having the show could go on.
By the way, I mentioned that you're one of the owners here in Central Pennsylvania. Peggy Steinman is well-known, the Steinman family, well-known in Lancaster County and throughout Central Pennsylvania, one of the other owners of Wasabi. Tell us about Wasabi himself. I've heard you describe him as just a cool dog.
Yeah, I mean, Wasabi is really just, he's just like a little buddy. You know, he's a great dog, a great little companion. Pekingese are bred to be, you know, little, you know, house dogs, basically, but he loves to go outside and run. He likes to walk up and down the driveway. You know, he's, you know, just a good little spirit, has a big heart. You know, a Pekingese is likened to be like a, they have the heart of a lion. You know, they're like a little lion dog. They have the big cape, you know, and the tail, and they're very, you know, very courageous for a small little dog. And Wasabi is, you know, he's certainly is like that.
Does a dog like Wasabi that competes with other dogs at dog shows like Westminster, I mean, it's almost like when you see the dogs at the, when we watch it on TV or if you see it in person, it's almost like these dogs have a confidence about them. Does Wasabi have that confidence?
Wasabi has that confidence big time. He is, you know, for a little dog, you know, he thinks he's a big dog. You know, he goes in the ring and, you know, commands attention, you know, stands his ground. He really, really has a, you know, a big attitude for a little guy.
And when you say that, what do you mean he has a big attitude for a little guy? In what way? Commands attention. I mean, in what way?
In what way? He walks around. He has a great carriage. He carries himself into the ring at a show like Westminster and keeps his head up, has sort of a pride of appearance, a pride of carriage. You know, he never really falters going around the ring, even though he walks slow and dignified. You know, when you stop, he just stands there. He doesn't sit down. He looks around, surveys the territory, when the judge comes down the line to inspect him and to, you know, see what he's doing. He looks the judge right in the eye. You know, he's just very at ease and has that confident demeanor.
You know, what you just described sound like the characteristics for a champion. Are they? I mean, are there other characteristics that champions have, or is that exactly what you just described? Is that how Wasabi became a champion?
Well, even before what I just described, every breed, and there are over 200 breeds recognized by the American Kennel Club, have their individual breed standards. You know, for each breed, they were bred for a purpose, whether it's herding, sporting, you know, a terrier going to ground, or most of the toy dogs just for companions. So they have to meet the standard for those breeds, for the correct eye, the correct body shape, the correct movement, coat, etc. And after that, if a dog meets the breed standard, to be a really great champion, they have to have the character to go with it. They have to have the demeanor. They have to enjoy being in the dog show. They have to, you know, like people. And, you know, all those things combine to make a dog that can compete, you know, on the level that Wasabi has competed on.
Mm-hmm. Now, was Wasabi bred to be a show dog, or maybe this is a chicken or egg question. When you have a dog, you say, you know what, that dog has the characteristics to be a good show dog. Which comes first?
Well, he was bred to be a great show dog. In his line, his grandfather was best in show at Westminster when it was held at Madison Square Garden in 2012. His father won the toy group at Westminster in 2017. And although these dogs are bred mostly to be wonderful pets and to be enjoyable companions, they also have a very, very, very good line of dogs that I've developed over the years. And he was bred to be, you know, a wonderful dog, but also to have those qualities to make him a great show dog.
You know, I probably a lot of us picture a dog like Wasabi, and as you describe him, as being almost the perfect dog. Is there ever a time when you say that, you know, these dogs were bred to be pets, but is there ever a time where you had to put your finger out to Wasabi and say, no, you're not supposed to be doing that?
Pretty much every day, if I'm having a snack, he'll start barking at me, and you know, for a piece of my snack. And he's very demanding when it comes to food. You know, he thinks he should be fed first and often.
Well, don't they all? I'm curious. What is Wasabi's favorite food? What's his favorite snack?
Well, I mean, he really is not picky. He will eat almost anything. If I'm having a piece of toast, he'll take a piece of toast. You know, he'll, you know, if you're having a, you know, a steak or something, he'll want that. Chicken, you know, I mean, he has, you know, he is not, does not have a very discriminating palate. He is a chow hound.
So I'm curious how you train dogs like Wasabi. What are the biggest challenges in training a dog like Wasabi to be a champion?
Well, the biggest challenge for breeding a dog to be a great champion and to compete at shows like Westminster is to have them so well socialized that they can walk into an arena with cheering crowd, with noises that they're not going to hear other places, and not be put off. You know, it's hard to replicate those kind of environments, but as a young puppy, you get them exposed to a lot of different people. You take them in the car and they go to little dog shows. They'll go to the, you know, market with you. You can walk them around, you know, different places, go to the park. And so that when they do grow up, they've already had this exposure. You're not really waiting to see if they turn out to be a great dog before you do do the exposure. And then, you know, you have to train them to walk on a lead, which is no big deal, really. Most every dog likes to walk on a lead and go with their owner. They also have to stand for examination for a little dog that's standing on a table, for a larger dog that's standing on a ramp or on the ground, and have the judge examine them. You know, a show dog is not really highly trained like an obedience dog. A show dog still, you have to show their personality, and they can wag their tail and they can do little things that, you know, show character, where an obedience animal has to be a little higher trained, and they have to sit, stay, you know, don't do, you know, so a show dog has, you know, a little, you want a little more spontaneity.
Does Wasabi enjoy training, or did he enjoy training?
He does enjoy training. He really is a fabulous dog. And when I say enjoy training, most of his training came pretty naturally. He was basically a born showman. Some dogs you have to coax along a little more. Wasabi, the first time I put his show lead on him, he walked with me like he knew what he was doing. You know, he was basically a natural. But he does enjoy it, you know. He loves going to the dog shows, and he really loves people. So it's not a hardship for a dog like Wasabi to go out and do what I expect of him. You know, he does it quite willingly.
I've always wondered how the dogs that are at dog shows keep from being distracted. As you said, that's one of the biggest challenges. But with so many other dogs around, I mean, let's face it, a regular, my dog, he sees another dog, that's where he wants to go. So how, I mean, is that one of the bigger challenges, to keep the dog from wanting to go over pay attention to other dogs rather than to the judges and what he's supposed to be paying attention to?
Well, a lot of that depends on the individual dog, you know. But when you show your dog, you really have to be at one with your dog. You have to have a bond with your dog where, you know, you're happy being together. The dog is happy and confident with you, and you have confidence in your dog that your dog is going to stay with you. Occasionally, there are dogs that get easily distracted, and those dogs would have to be trained more. But you know, and certain breeds, really, like terriers, like to look at each other and, you know, spar and things like that. Most of your companion animals and, you know, dogs don't really want to get to the other dogs. They are very happy to be with their owner and their handler. But, you know, occasionally, you know, but the dog really has to know who the boss is, too, and, you know, have respect for the handler, so that if you do have an occasion where they're trying to get after something else, you can give them a little tug on the lead and, you know, off you go. They get back with you.
We had a question from a listener and wanted to know what other dogs or breeds at Westminster this year did you see as the biggest competition?
Well, really, the biggest competition proved to be the reserve best in show winner, the Whippet. And going into the show, in my mind, I thought the Whippet would win best in show. Mrs. Trotter, the best in show judge, is one of the great breeders in the world of Norwegian Elkhounds. Well, she is the greatest breeder of Norwegian Elkhounds, but one of the greatest dog breeders of all time in general, as well as an author, a dog show judge, and just, you know, an icon of our sport. And I thought she would favor the hound going in there, which ended up being the Whippet. And obviously she really liked it because she placed it reserve best in show. So, you know, I think Wasabi had to shine extra bright to get past that Whippet.
You know, one of the questions I've heard a lot of people asking since Sunday when Wasabi was named the champion, is how do you keep him looking the way he is? I mean, obviously, Pekingese with longer hair, and I mean, he doesn't look like he has a hair out of place. How long does that take each day, or when he goes in the show, to get him in shape physically?
Yeah, well, it's a process that starts, you know, from when they're a puppy, because you just take good care of your dog every day. You know, he'll, you know, as a puppy, he would be put on the table and brushed daily, you know, sometimes for 15 minutes, sometimes for 30 minutes, and it continued throughout his life. And so when the dogs are kept up on a continuous basis, it's really not all that much preparation before the show. There is preparation, of course, and a little more intensity, but you know, he gets 30 to 45 minutes a day approximately. And before the show, he'll get a nice bath. And the day of the show, you know, he's fluffed up, you know, and brushed continuously through the day. But, you know, it's sporadic, you know. And if the dog needs his rest, then you'll brush him a little less and just let him rest. If he's up to it, you might brush him a little bit longer. You know, in a show like Westminster, where the competition is so intense, you know, the grooming is a little bit more intense there too.
So what is in Wasabi's future?
Well, he has really done it all. You know, as a year-old dog in 2019, December in Orlando, he won the American Kennel Club show, which was the largest show of the year. He was the first toy dog to win that show, and he was also the youngest dog to win that show. Last year, even with the pandemic and most shows being canceled, he competed in 96 dog shows, and in 2020, he was the top dog of all breeds. This year, I didn't show him much because I was wanting to rest him for Westminster. Took him out a few times just to keep his feet wet. And then, you know, we were lucky enough to do so well at Westminster. So for all intents and purposes, he'll be retired, you know, except maybe for a special show in the, you know, future. In the fall, there's a show called Mars and Essex, which was Geraldine Rockefeller Dodge's personal dog show, which has been resurrected in the last 20 years, and they only hold it every 5 years. Last year, they couldn't have it because of the pandemic, and they're going to hold it this October in New Jersey, near where her estate was. I would like to take him there, but I might not. So, for all intents and purposes, for regular competition, he's retired.
David Fitzpatrick was the breeder. He's one of the part owners and handlers of Wasabi, who won the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show Best in Show last weekend. Mr. Fitzpatrick, thank you very much for being with us, and congratulations again.
Oh, thank you too, sir.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up tonight on WITF-TV at 8 o'clock, it's a very timely program, Transforming Health, Mental Health After a Pandemic. Joining us is Transforming Health producer and host, Kira McGuire. Kira, always good to talk with you.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
All right, so tell me about Transforming Health, Mental Health After a Pandemic. What to look for on the program?
Right. So this show really takes a look at kind of what we've been through since the COVID-19 pandemic began and how it's affecting our mental health. So we've all experienced in some way this feeling of fear or isolation or worry. And what kind of remains to be seen is how these feelings will impact our mental health moving forward. And we can take a look also at how we've seen them already impact our mental health. So on this show, I talk with mental health experts. I speak with an author, a meditation expert, and most importantly, maybe with folks who already had a mental illness going into the pandemic and how they kind of navigated that. And they offer tips for others. So that's kind of my favorite part of the show.
You say that was your favorite part of the show. What sticks out to you, the people that you spoke with or in your research and putting this show together, what really sticks with you?
I think kind of the importance for connection. This show really highlights in speaking with the experts and also in speaking with the folks who have been dealing with mental illness and folks that are, you know, newer to these feelings. It's really this feeling of connection that everybody stresses is so important. So the pandemic really pushed us apart. And also this time of kind of social unrest has pushed us apart in many ways and separate us into groups and whatnot. Everybody kind of stresses that moving forward, the most important thing kind of to finding our way through this will be connecting to each other and kind of relying on each other. So that's a special part of the show.
When you say connection, I mean, one of the things that I think of is that what many of us have realized over the past year plus is that we as a species, that we need that connection with other people, that that's one of the things that fulfills our lives, makes us happy, or just it's something that we need. I mean, is that something that came out in the show?
Absolutely. We interviewed an author. She's actually WITF's summer read author this year. Her book is called You Belong, A Call for Connection. So over the summer, you know, many people will be joining along and reading this book. And that's kind of the highlight of it. And so as part of this show, I was able to interview that author. Her name is Sebene Selassie. And she really stresses the importance for connection. She says that, you know, growing up, she really longed for this sense of belonging, and the way she found it was through meditation. And she's kind of been on this journey of the importance of belonging and the importance of this interconnection between all of us. And so she really stresses that importance and how it can help folks to kind of see our differences and respect them, but also have them unite us instead of separate us. It's a lofty concept, but at the same time, it's very interesting. And she was definitely a highlight of the show.
You mentioned that you did speak with some people who maybe had some mental health episodes or mental health issues during the pandemic. What did you hear?
Yeah. So folks who were already dealing with mental illness at the start of the pandemic, I spoke with two different people who shared their experiences. And both of these individuals were at a decent place in their kind of understanding of how to live with their mental illness. So they navigated it, you know, to the best of their ability, but they could really understand how if they had come to COVID-19 prior to having treatment, it could be really crippling. And so they were able to share how they found their way through and then also offer tips to others, which I found very, very important as part of the show. They offer tips to others who might just be starting to realize that they're dealing with a little bit of something and looking for a way to navigate it. So yeah, that part, the tips, I think, will be very impactful.
What kind of tips?
Both of them really, they share that importance of connection again. So from both of them, you know, they express how it can be really hard when you're feeling down or when you're feeling like you're struggling a bit to want to reach out, but that can be actually the most important thing to reach out to people that you may not have even thought you would reach out to, or talk to people that you may not have even thought that you would normally speak with, but these connections can really come in handy at times when you wouldn't expect them to, maybe. So that was from both of these folks, kind of their takeaway was to really try to stay connected with people, and that can really help you pull through.
The program is Transforming Health, Mental Health After a Pandemic. It will be broadcast on WITF-TV tonight at 8. Very timely program. Kira, I want to thank you for being with us today and for producing this program. We only have about 20 seconds left. Also want to mention that the Transforming Health website, there's a new website today, right?
That's right. You can check it out today. As of this morning, a new and improved Transforming Health website. That's at transforminghealth.org. And you can watch this new episode after 8 p.m. tonight and see all the other episodes there as well.
Kira McGuire, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.